In April 2014, officials in Flint, Michigan switched the source of the city's water from the Detroit water supply to the Flint River. It was a cost-saving move, but it touched the lives of citizens across that city. Today's guest helped blow the story open. With science and determination, she proved the decision was poisoning the children of Flint. She's Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha this week on Story in the Public Square. And welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. To do that, we sit down every week with the best storytellers around, authors, journalists, filmmakers, and more, to make sense of the big stories shaping public life in the United States today. To help us this week, we're joined by Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha, the crusading pediatrician in Flint, Michigan, who helped confirm the city's water crisis. She's written about it in her book, What the Eyes Don't See. And she's with us in Providence today because of the Rhode Island Center for the Book, who selected What the Eyes Don't See as its selection for its annual statewide read. Dr. Mona, thank you so much for being with us.
It's great to be with you.
So for those of us who don't maybe haven't read the book or have don't maybe only know tangentially what happened in Flint, what happened in Flint?
Well, what happened in Flint is a water crisis. So in 2014, in really kind of a corrosion of democracy and a move towards austerity, we changed our water source to the local Flint River to save dollars. So we went from Great Lakes water, which we had been using for about a half a century, to the Flint River to save money. And the Flint River water wasn't treated properly. It was missing an ingredient called corrosion control, which made it about 20 times more corrosive than the water we were getting from the Great Lakes. And that corrosive water ate up our pipes, which had lead in it. The lead began to flow into our drinking water and into the bodies of our children for about 18 months.
How did you find yourself in the middle of all this?
A lot of my kind of involvement happened by serendipity. So I happened to be home with a high school girlfriend who, of all things, was a drinking water expert. We've been friends for about 20 years, and our kids were running around and playing together, having a glass of wine. And she's like, "Hey, Mona, have you heard about what's going on in Flint's water?" And I'm like, "You know, I've heard about what my patients are concerned about and what I hear in the local media, color and odor and taste and bacteria. And I've also been hearing a lot of reassurance from state officials that the water is okay." And she's the one that shared with me that the water wasn't being treated with this important ingredient. And because of that, there would be lead in the water. And from that very moment, you know, my life really changed because when a pediatrician hears the word lead, it's a call to action.
Well, so why is lead so bad?
Lead is probably the world's most well-studied neurotoxins. We've known what lead has done for centuries. It is potent, it's irreversible, it's a poison. Incredible science over the last few decades has gotten us to the point of recognizing that there is no safe level of lead in a child. And its dangers are mainly in what it does to children. It really impacts the core of what it means to be you, impacting cognition. So it actually drops IQ levels, impacts behavior, leads to things like developmental delays and attention disorders and focusing problems. And it's even been linked to things like criminality. So what we're supposed to do in medicine and public health is something called primary prevention. We're never supposed to expose a population to lead because what it does to children.
Oh. So you talked about this was done to save money. What kind of money, what sums were being talked about that we would save by going to this new source of water?
Yeah, so Flint was in a state of near bankruptcy, and we were under the control of a financial emergency manager. And at that point in Michigan, many of our cities, our predominantly minority cities, were taken over by emergency managers, all to save dollars and to kind of balance the books. So there was a lot of cost cutting that was happening by these emergency managers. They were, you know, wanting to, you know, sell off our public hospital. And in Detroit, where it happened.
Seriously?
Yeah, in Detroit, they wanted to sell off our Detroit Institute of Arts. efforts, and that kind of finally saved that city from its bankruptcy state. So it was, the savings were in the order of millions. Flint was buying its water from Detroit, the Great Lakes water, and they were fed up with paying Detroit. And, you know, they thought that they could save money by moving to the Flint River until a new pipeline was to be built to the Great Lakes. So the move to the Flint River was supposed to be temporary until a new pipeline was to be built. And I think the savings were in the order of, I don't know, like $20 to $30 million. And the greatest irony in this story is that this treatment chemical that was missing, this corrosion control, only would have cost $80 to $100 a day. That's all it would have cost.
Nobody foresaw this in the planning. I mean, this was not done, you know, on Mars. This was done in America, in a major state near a major city.
So, you know, this is why it is so mind-boggling and why I really felt compelled to write this book, because this was happening on American soil in the 21st century in the richest country in the history of the world.
Right.
And of greatest irony, in Michigan. So Michigan's the mitten state. We are surrounded by
water.
Yeah. We're surrounded by the Great Lakes. The Great Lakes are the largest source of fresh water in the world. Wherever you are in Michigan, you're like an hour away from fresh water. And here's Flint, literally in the middle of the largest source of fresh water in the world, in America, in the 21st century, and where we, where bureaucrats have made the decision to save money by going from a high quality water source to a lower quality water source on the backs of poor and minority people.
I mean, I just have an image of these bureaucrats, whoever they were, in a room totaling up the dollars.
Yeah.
Boom, boom, cha-ching, cha-ching. Yeah. And oh, by the way, the health. Mm.
Exactly. There was no consideration of children's health, environmental health, public health.
Well, one of the things that I love about this book, and I really love this book, the role of the emergency managers. This is something that a lot of municipalities across the country have dealt with in the last decade and a half. But you argue that this is about the diminution of democracy.
Absolutely. This is probably the most egregious examples of what happens when we take away democracy. Literally overnight, Flint lost control of our locally elected officials, and we became under the control of somebody who just reported to the governor who had no accountability. And that's why this story is not an isolated story. It really speaks to what's happening across our nation in regards to the breakdown of democracy. This is no different than efforts as voter suppression and gerrymandering and mass incarceration. These are all different ways that democracy is being taken away from some of our most vulnerable citizens.
And as you said, we're the richest society in the history of our species. It's words fail me. So how did you get involved writing about it? You're a pediatrician by training. Had you done any writing before? By the way, pediatricians, along with primary care people, are like sacred. Seriously, they're like, you know, in terms of healthcare, they are the most important pieces, I think.
It is a privilege to be a pediatrician. I absolutely wake up every day and I pinch myself to be able to care for my kids in Flint. And it's a wonderful, wonderful profession where you can do a lot of science and service, but a lot of advocacy. Advocacy is very much part of our work.
And a lot of prevention, as you said.
Prevention.
It's a critical piece of this.
Our work is embedded in public health. It's not as much about the kid in front of me today, but it's really about the promise and the potential of that child. What's going to happen to that kid in 5, 10, 15 years?
That young brain that's getting poisoned by lead that will never be the adult brain it could be.
Exactly, because what was happening in our water was really threatening the tomorrows of all of our children. As to being a writer, so I grew up a reader. I always kind of devoured books as a child. Reading was really kind of the religion of my family, being well-read. I was the publisher of our high school paper.
Publisher, but not editor.
Maybe it was editor / publisher. I don't remember.
I like publishers, so don't get me wrong here.
So went on to college, and my undergrad major was more like environmental science. I started out as like an environmental activist, organizer, really started to understand the connections between environment and health, but then really also got immersed in creative writing classes, stayed another year in college really to take fun classes like creative writing.
Yeah.
Reading and writing have always been a passion, and I strongly believe that no matter what profession you go into, you need to be a good writer.
Talk to us, if you can, about the title of the book, What the Eyes Don't See. So when I first started reading the book, I'm like, I'm not sure what this is.
Yeah.
But you very quickly explained that really is a central theme to the book, but I think more to the way you approach medicine, too.
Absolutely. So what the eyes don't see means many different things. And I look forward to readers kind of digesting it on their own and finding the many, many kind of themes that of that title. So first and foremost, it means the quite literal. So we don't see lead in water. It's invisible. It's odorless. It's tasteless. If you remember those pictures from Flint, that kind of brown water, yellow water.
Oh, yeah.
That was from iron corrosion because the iron pipes were also corroding. And that gave you that rust colored water. But lead in water is invisible. We don't see it. We also don't see the effects of lead. Back in the day when we had lead in paint and gasoline, children were presenting to our ERs with seizures and coma and could acutely die from acute lead poisoning.
And a lot of that came from paint.
From paint and gasoline.
And gasoline.
We don't see those high levels anymore. What we see right now is something called a silent pediatric epidemic. It's asymptomatic. Children, people think like, oh, you've figured this out because kids were coming to your clinic, right, with problems. That's not what was happening because the symptoms of lead exposure are asymptomatic. They're subclinical, which actually makes it more dangerous. Like, I wish kids would present with like glow-in-the-dark spots, then we know that they're exposed to lead and we could do something about it. But unfortunately, it's asymptomatic. So it's a silent, we don't see the consequences of lead exposure, if not years or decades or generations later, which makes it so much more harmful. In addition, the title, really, the first time I heard that title was when I was a doctor in training, when I was a pediatric resident, and one of my supervising doctors, an attending in our intensive care unit, would really drill us at the bedside, especially if we couldn't figure out a diagnosis, and he would always say, the eyes don't see what the mind doesn't know. And it's a D.H. Lawrence distillation, really telling us and reminding us that, hey, we need to read more. You need to study because you're not going to diagnose something or pick up something if you don't even know that it exists. And that kind of speaks to my blindness because I never even knew about the possibility that lead could be in water, which really shows how kind of eyes closed I was because the word lead actually means plumbing. Lead comes from the Latin PB, which comes from plumbum, which means plumbing. So the word lead actually means plumbing. But the bigger meaning of this title, what the eyes don't see, it goes way beyond Flint. It is about people and places and problems that we choose not to see. And it is really, I hope that this book is a rallying cry for all of us to open our eyes. But it is not enough to be awake. It is more important to act towards the injustices that are happening all around us.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard 4 times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with an immensely talented crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to catch up with me on Twitter, you can do so at J.M. Lutis. Joining me as he does every week is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller, an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. Wayne is also the author of 17 books. You can find Wayne on Twitter too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is the pediatrician from Flint, Michigan, Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha, who would not stop fighting for the children of her city and provided the evidence that confirmed that they were being poisoned by lead in their drinking water. She's the author of What the Eyes Don't See and is on Twitter at Mona Hannah A. That's MonaHannaA.
You were one of the first to sound an alarm here. What was the reaction when you publicly brought attention to this?
Yeah, so I was actually kind of late in the story. So the water crisis had been going on for like a year and a half. And I think of it like a series of dominoes. Like the heroic and brave people of Flint, they knew something was wrong and they were loud and organized. And then there was really incredible journalists who were on the story.
And it was known that it was lead.
No, they didn't know it was lead.
Okay.
They knew that there was something going
on. Something was going on, but
right.
We weren't sure what.
Right. And
Something not right.
Just a few months after we switched our water source, General Motors, which was born in Flint and still has plants in Flint, noticed that this water was corroding their engine parts. And they were allowed to go back to Great Lakes water.
That's a tell.
Yeah. That's a red flag. That is like alarm bell sirens should have gone off. That should have been the end of this crisis. And that was a full year before I was involved in this story.
So when you began drawing attention. But what was the reaction?
Yeah, so I once I heard about the possibility of lead and water, you know, like I said, there was no going back. There was only going forward. And I conducted the research, which is kind of detailed in this book, to see what was happening to our children, to see if our children were increasingly being exposed to the lead. Then very publicly shared this research, which is not something you do in academia. You publish and present.
Yeah, not typically, right. You're
right. But I shared it at a press conference because our children did not have another
day. It wasn't peer-reviewed.
It was an academic no-no. So I literally walked out of my clinic and I stood up at a press conference to share this research.
That's brave. But
there was no other option.
Well,
is what had to be done. And right away, just like everybody else who had raised concerns, moms and pastors and activists and journalists and water scientists, just like everybody else, I was dismissed and attacked.
Why do you think, though? I mean, there's a crescendo of, I'm not going to use the word, but coming to people's attention. Why wasn't...
You know, that's like the...
Why weren't the public health officials and the officials paying attention and not dismissing?
That's a great question, and that's why we have ongoing efforts at accountability and justice. Those investigations are ongoing to this date in terms of why did this happen, why weren't people paying attention, and why was public health and children's health not the foremost rather than saving dollars.
Well, there are a lot of critics of what happened in Flint who say that this was about race.
Mm-hmm.
And your book, I think, sort of explores that link between environmental justice and social justice in really profound ways. Can you unpack that for our audience a little bit?
Absolutely. So the concept of environmental injustice is the recognition that people who are poor and people who are predominantly minority disproportionately suffer from the burden of environmental contaminations. This is not a new concept. It's been really kind of well established for about three decades and well studied throughout this nation of kind of crises that happen or burdens that happen predominantly on poor and Black people. And Flint is another egregious example and probably kind of the most profound in this young century of an environmental injustice. Many investigations have been done, including an investigation from the Michigan Civil Rights Commission, as well as the governor's own task force that clearly say that this was another case of environmental injustice where the race and the demographics of the population perpetuated this crisis. Other folks, for example, Michael Moore, who's from Flint, Jesse Jackson and others have clearly said that this is a racial crisis, that it never would have happened in a richer or a whiter community.
Are there people who would dispute that now? I mean, it's obvious and clear to us.
I don't think so. I think it's been well established. Yeah, and there's been also many kind of academic articles and other folks that have lended kind of their wisdom and also shared that, yes, this is in a form of environmental injustice that continues and is not, once again, isolated to Flint. These are things that are happening throughout our nation where poor and minority folks disproportionately suffer from environmental contamination.
That's because of the zip codes where they live and the legacy of industry in certain areas.
I think a kind of lack of political voice, industry's ability to manipulate those communities and to, for example, put polluting factories or what have you in those environments. So it goes back to the title of What the Eyes Don't See. These are populations that we choose not to see and thus choose not to value. And they disproportionately suffer from these things.
Where does your personal sense of justice and injustice come from?
Yeah, so I think if you pick up this book and you think it's a Flint book, I think you'll be taken aback because it's not just a Flint book. This book weaves very much my personal story and my family history. And I felt that it was important for the readers to know who I am, to understand that what I do and why I do it is really rooted in my deep kind of family upbringing and sense of justice. So that means that this book is very much an immigrant story. I'm a first generation immigrant, came to this country when I was 4 years old.
From where?
We're Iraqi American. So I was actually born in the UK. My father was getting his PhD there, but the plan was to go back to Baghdad, where my family is from. But that was the rise of Saddam Hussein. And my parents could not go back to a country where they were seeing really the effects of injustice back home. The rise of fascism and tyranny and oppression and dictatorship. So my parents decided to move to the States, and we came to this country for what everybody comes to this country for as immigrants, for freedom and opportunity and democracy, for that American dream. And I absolutely wake up every single day fortunate to be a recipient of that American dream, but also acutely aware of what injustice can be. And my parents never shielded me from what was happening back home. I acutely remember, and this is described in the book, I think I was 11 or 12 years old, and my father was trying to kind of devour anything that was in the news about Iraq, and there was not much in the news at that time. And he would have memberships and subscriptions to like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, and he shared with me a picture from the massacre in Halabja. If you remember, in northern Iraq, Saddam Hussein poisoned an entire village of his own people, a Kurdish population. 5,000 people died that day. And he showed me this picture of his beautiful baby girl wrapped in a pink blanket with her father, both of them dead on the street. That is kind of the milieu of how I grew up, recognizing that people in power can do terrible things to populations that they don't.
Boy, is that not true historically and today as well? There's another major issue that Flint brings to the surface and you write about and would like you to talk about too, and that's the infrastructure of this country today.
Yeah.
Water supplies, bridges, roads, railroads. We can go through a litany of, I mean, just drive anywhere, basically.
Yeah. Absolutely. So that is why this story is also not an isolated to Flint story, because it also very much speaks to the disintegration of our critical infrastructure due to inequality and austerity. We think that our roads and our bridges are bad. What's underneath is even worse and has not had significant investment. Specifically in regards to lead in our plumbing, it's even hard to believe that we actually have a neurotoxin delivering our drinking water throughout this country. Not until 1986 did we restrict the use of lead service lines, which are the pipes that go from the water main to the front of the house. But not until 2014 did we restrict the use of lead in fixtures and faucets.
Well, a lot of those lead pipes are still there.
No, they're still there.
They're like everywhere. Still.
They're everywhere, especially in the Northeast and the Midwest, in older cities. I was in Philadelphia a few months ago, and they had a water main break. They dug up the water main. They're like, oh, this was installed when Calvin Coolidge was president.
Yeah.
So that is throughout our nation, and we really need massive investment in infrastructure. And I'm hopeful that this is something that can be bipartisan supported and can then also reap the benefits of employment and other opportunities.
So give us an update. What's the status of water in Flint now?
Yeah, so Flint is doing that infrastructure work, which is amazing. So for the 18 months that we were on this corrosive water that ate up our pipes, that damaged our pipes, and those pipes are being replaced right now, which is awesome.
Yeah.
That will be done in a few months, and then we'll be only the third city in the country that has replaced their lead service lines, which is phenomenal. But while we're doing that infrastructure earth-moving work, it requires people to remain on precautions with filtered water and bottled water because of the disruption that can happen in the lead scale during that work, and that's why people are still on the precautions right now.
You talked about the possibility of a bipartisan effort to rebuild the infrastructure. Do you think that's realistic now in this current climate? And we could describe in detail the current climate, but I think we know what the current climate is, where there aren't a lot of people necessarily in Washington who are paying attention to that, as opposed to a wall.
Yeah, you know, I think infrastructure, unlike things like immigration and healthcare, is something that both sides can agree is important for all their constituents. It's something that constituents and communities all over need investment in. So I see that as something that's more favorable than other kind of very polarizing topics that we are dealing with right now in the nation. But because a lot of this is not happening at the federal level, we're seeing a lot of innovation and creativity and leadership at the state and local levels. And that has been reaffirming. For example, Michigan, because of the lessons of Flint, has a new lead and copper rule at the state level, which is mandating that all of our pipes in the state be replaced in the next 20 years. So there have been some really positive Flint ripple effects, but have really kind of resonated at the local state levels because of federal kind of inaction paralysis.
Well, I guess half a loaf is better than none, right? The local and regional level.
You describe in the book, though, sort of your surprise when one of your partners in exposing what was happening in Flint turned out to be a conservative Republican. Mm-hmm. So there's more to it than just sort of meets the eye.
Yeah, so, and that is absolutely one of the reasons I wrote this book, because we are in this really bizarre, divisive state of our nation right now. And this is a story of how unexpected people came together. People of different ideologies, of different backgrounds, of different professions came together on behalf of our children. And that is a story that we need right now. I mean, yes, the story of Flint is a story of a crime committed with absolute indifference against some of the most vulnerable people. But it is also how everyday people from all over, moms and pastors and activists and students and teachers and doctors and scientists and water folks, came together from very, very different and diverse backgrounds to find something that they all could rally towards. And that's an important lesson that we need right now, especially in this really divisive state that we're in.
So we discuss a lot of issues on this show on a weekly basis. Some are international, some are national. And a question we often ask our guests is if you, the viewer or listener of the show, is concerned about the issues we've talked about today, what would you advise? What can the quote-unquote ordinary citizen do?
Yeah, so this book is, it's very much a Flint book. The story is very much kind of about what happened in Flint and kind of a call to action for all of us to kind of be aware and alert and recognize what's happening in our communities. And a lot of people go away and they're like, oh, I want to help Flint. And if you want to help Flint, great. You know, you could donate to our Flint Kids Fund, which is one of the reasons I wrote this book. Part of the proceeds go back to that fund, flintkids.org. But by and large, I tell folks, you do not need to come to Flint. You do not need to help Flint. You just need to find something that you're passionate about. Turn on the news. There are injustices happening right around us. We cannot afford to have a society with their eyes closed and silent to the injustices. Kids at the border separated from their parents, our inaction on climate change, on gun violence, the constant threats to social safety net programs, healthcare, rising drug prices, slavery morphed into mass incarceration. You pick it, you pick what's passionate and put your energy towards that. And that is something that everybody can do and can do today. We just need an engaged citizenship.
Wow.
That's a hell of a point.
No kidding.
So we've got about 30 seconds left. What's next for you?
Retirement. No, just kidding.
I don't believe that for a second.
I am privileged. I feel blessed to have this amazing microphone to be able to advocate and, especially with this book, to be able to advocate not only for Flint children, but children all over, because the stories are not isolated. There are kids all over this nation who really wake up to some of the same nightmares of our Flint kids, be it poverty, injustice, austerity, lost democracy, stolen opportunity. And I will continue to do kind of my part to make sure that kids throughout this country have the best opportunity.
And the country's going to be better for it. Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha, thank you so much for being with us. The book is What the Eyes Don't See. You should check it out. That's all the time we have this week. But if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter or visit pellcenter.org. We can always catch up on previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.